love is not just about you. It's about us. It's not just about me. It's about we. And that makes all the difference in the world. And that way of love is potentially the most revolutionary movement in all of human reality.
That's Bishop Michael Curry. And today, as part of our 75th anniversary celebration, he offers a powerful sermon entitled, Not Just Me, But We. I'm Peter Wallace, and this is Day One.
Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's historic Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. In 1945, we began broadcasting every week as the Protestant Hour, and since 2002, as Day One. In 2020, we proudly celebrate 75 years of sharing the good news of Jesus Christ around the world. Now, here's your host, Peter Wallace, to introduce today's preacher.
Thank you, Sherry. Today on Day One, as we continue our special series celebrating our 75 years on the radio, we're delighted to have with us the Most Reverend Michael B. Curry, presiding bishop and primate of the Episcopal Church. Michael was installed in 2015 to a 9-year term. Previously, he served as bishop of the Diocese of North Carolina for 15 years and earlier served churches in North Carolina, Ohio, and Baltimore. He is a graduate of Hobart College in New York and received his Master of Divinity degree from Yale Divinity School, with additional studies at Princeton Theological Seminary, Wake Forest University, and other institutions. He is the author of several books, including Crazy Christians, Songs My Grandma Sang, and a new one just out called Love is the Way, Holding on to Hope in Troubling Times. Bishop Michael, welcome to Day One.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you for having me.
In this anniversary series, we are presenting leaders from some of the institutions and denominations that we have worked with over the past 75 years since the founding of the Protestant Hour. And while the Episcopal Church was not part of the ecumenical mix at the very beginning, it did join in this work just a couple of years later through the Episcopal Media Center. And I'm so glad that you have played a major role in this work over the past few decades, starting back when you were a rector, then as Bishop of North Carolina, and now as presiding bishop of the church, a regular preacher, former trustee on our board, member of our Day One Advisory Board. We're very grateful for you. When you look back over your own ministry history, what brings you joy and hope for the future?
Well, you know, one of the realities is that there are people of genuine and devout and real faith who actually are making a profound difference where they are and certainly in this country and around the world. I mean, one of the real joys of my particular position is that I travel, or at least I did before COVID-19, a lot. I mean, I live on the road. Mm-hmm. And I get to see and experience people, I mean, normal people doing extraordinary things, remarkable things, ways of service that actually make a tangible, practical difference in the world. I remember there was a play that was really kind of about, it was about racial segregation here in the South. And it imagined what would happen if all the blacks just kind of disappeared. Mm. I think the title was The Day of Absence. And literally the infrastructure of the town and the economy where the play was set just stopped and fell apart. I kind of have an image of churches and religious folk, the ones who are doing the hard, good work of love, can be taken for granted. But imagine if they weren't there. Imagine, I mean, the soup kitchens that wouldn't be happening. Imagine the work of advocacy that wouldn't be happening. Imagine the acts of kindness that wouldn't be happening. If take them out of our history and all the hospitals named St. Francis and Murphy and St. Joseph and whatever, hospitals and colleges and institutions and schools that were founded by people of religious conviction would cease to exist. Our HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, many of them were founded by religious communities and religious people to educate newly freed slaves. The ordinary Christian, The ordinary person of faith is absolutely extraordinary. And I've gotten to see them.
Mm. You've become known worldwide as a powerful preacher, particularly after you preached at the wedding of the royals, Harry and Meghan. That event points out the power of proclaiming God's way of love in the media and online. Mm-hmm. Why is that so important, especially these days?
Well, you know, Peter, I it's important for a couple of reasons. One, I think that love, and I'm using the word, I know we only have one word for love, mm-hmm. but what love is really about, particularly as the scriptures point to it and as the New Testament points to it, is really about an unselfish way of living. Mm-hmm. That if you look at, for example, in 1 Corinthians 13, where Paul has that great passage about love, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I am a noisy gong, a clanging cymbal. Now faith, hope, and love abide, these three, but the greatest of these is love. But if you read what's in between, love is not jealous. Love mm-hmm. is not rude. Love does not insist on its own way. He's describing a way of unselfish, sacrificial living. And if you look at 1 Corinthians 13 in the context of 1 Corinthians, you'll realize that he's actually seeing love as the cure, if you will, for a community that was tearing itself apart by unbridled selfishness and factions and divisions. Mm-hmm. He saw this way of love, this way of unselfish living, as the cure, if you will, for factionalism, division, selfish living, and selfish action, which is the root cause of all the humanly created maladies in the world. It is selfishness that will drive us into the ground. And love is the balm in Gilead, if you will, mm-hmm. the healing power that can show us, as St. Paul actually says, a still more excellent way. And so I think that message and the message of love itself has some resonating power when we move it beyond the merely sentimental and beyond mere sentiment to a real commitment to a way of living that actually seeks to be unselfish, that seeks the good and the welfare and the well-being of others, a way of life that lives about we and not just about me.
Mm. Part of your media ministry is a new podcast you're doing. Tell us about that and some of the folks you've talked with.
Well, one of them I want to talk with is Peter Wallace. And if you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
Okay.
But I got to get you on it because one of the things I've tried to do on that podcast is to put people in touch with remarkable people that I've gotten to know or met over time who actually are engaged in the ongoing work of trying to live a life that's defined and shaped by a love that is really unselfish, that seeks to bless and be blessed. I've interviewed folk from evangelists to social justice advocates and across the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And spent time with Richard Rohr and, you know, Jim Wallace and folk like that. And as well as just a variety of remarkable people, evangelists online, and a young man who is Asian and gay, who actually went and was in relationship with some of the folk of churches that go around talking about God hates gays, and he actually went to be in relationship with them as fellow human beings, fellow children of God. I mean, I get run into these incredible people. They're out there. They don't make all the big news all the time, but I'm telling you, they are world changers, which is why I got to get you on this, Peter.
Of course, the coronavirus pandemic has made a huge impact on the work of the church. Do you think these practices will change the church in some ways in the future?
Well, there's no way that they can't. Mm. How? I don't know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, none of us knows because we're living in it. But I do think, for example, I mean, just a simple thing. Most of our churches, and I know for Episcopal churches, we've had to at least for a while and probably still in many contexts, we've had to kind of close the doors of the church in terms of physical worshiping. And we've had to find ways to be able to facilitate worship without being physically present. Now, you know, it dawned on me that we should know that this is possible because Jesus in John chapter 4 says those who, it doesn't matter whether you worship on, remember the conversation mm-hmm. with the Samaritan woman? Doesn't matter whether you worship on Mount Gerizim or Mount Zion, those who worship God must worship in spirit and in truth. Mm. Worshiping God is not a matter of place and location and physicality, but about worshiping God in spirit and in truth. So we should have known that it was possible to worship without being physically present in a physical building. But nonetheless, I, like everybody else, for a moment had to figure out, well, how in the world are we going to have church if we can't go to the physical church? Mm-hmm. How are we going to have Holy Week? How are we going to observe Holy Week when we can't physically be together? How are we going to do it when we can't give out palms and have Palm Sunday procession? How are we going to do it? How are we going to do Holy Week if we can't wash each other's feet on Monday, mm-hmm. Thursday? Mm-hmm. How are we going to do it if we don't hear those seven last words on Good Friday? How are we going to do it if we can't have that great vigil of Easter Eve where there are candles and baptisms? Hallelujah, Christ is risen. How are we going to do it when we have the great Easter morning services where churches are filled to the brim? Mm. How are we going to do that? Well, doggone it, these churches figured it out. Mm-hmm. They went online. It's kind of like the church had its origins underground, where we went above ground and this time went online, over the ground, and figured out how to do it, how to worship God in spirit and in truth. And we've done it. The blessing of that has been that it has put us in contact with many people who have gone to church, if you will, online, who might not come to the doors of our churches. Mm. And so we must not leave the new congregation that we have discovered or that has discovered us. We must not leave them when we're physically able to return to the church build, the literal church buildings. Mm-hmm. I think that is one dramatic way we're going to see a shift. Churches are going to realize that they have multiple congregations, some that are physically present and some that are present in the virtual space, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's a remarkable opportunity, but not one that we anticipated or that I anticipated or expected. And yet it's created a new possibility that I don't think is going to go away. That's just one example. And you know, I mean, we're learning. I've had folk who have kind of learned, how do you stay in touch with people who are online if that's the only time and way that you see them? And somebody said, well, you have virtual greeters, just like you have greeters in a physical church, have virtual greeters who are greeting people as they're commenting during the service and that kind of thing. And you figure out ways to stay in touch, just to have a pastoral touch and presence. I think we're learning how to reach out to new folk, if you will, not just beyond the doors of the church. This is bigger than thinking out of the box mm-hmm. or going beyond the doors. This is even where there are no doors. Hmm. This is going where we have never been before, and we're not going to go completely back in the same way. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like that Bible passage in, was it 1 John says, it doth not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Well, it does not yet appear what the church will be on the other side of COVID-19. Mm. But hopefully we'll look a little bit more like Jesus.
Michael, you have a new book just out, and just in time, it sounds like, because it's called Love is the Way, Holding on to Hope in Troubling Times. Give us a taste of what you offer in that book.
Well, you know, I have to admit that there was a part of me that kind of resisted it because they said, no, go through your life. And we want to know, where does this conviction about love, where does it come from in your life? Where have you seen it and experienced it? And so I ended up kind of going through stories of my life, everything from a remarkable grandmother who I've written about a little bit in another context, but going a little bit deeper to the time when my mother Had a massive cerebral hemorrhage and was in a coma for a year and a half and eventually died. And the whole experience of being a child who loses his mother and what that was like and the and how love of people actually sustained me and my sister and our family through a time of real hardship and tragedy. I go through stories of being a young ordained person in churches serving a small congregation in a rural black community, and then later in Baltimore and North Carolina, what it was like to and how I saw the power of love both change me and change people around me and kind of guide us. I mean, in actual stories, this stuff really happened. And I realized that this way of love that Jesus taught, it is dynamite. It is real power. And it can help us navigate complex and uncertain territory. And it can give us strength that we don't have necessarily simply on our own. And it can, you know, it can, with like the old song says, love lifted me when nothing else would help. Love lifted me. That's not just a church song. It's really true. And I've experienced it in my own life. And I've seen it in the life of the world. I've seen it. And so the book is about how I've seen love and what I've learned from it. Mm-hmm. And there's some stories of where love forced me to grow in ways that I never envisioned, sometimes painfully, but genuinely how to grow and how to live and maybe be a slightly better human being for it.
Well, I can't wait to read that.
Oh, I'll make sure you get a copy. I'll make sure of that, Peter.
Thank you. Bishop, I'm asking all our preachers in this anniversary series this question. In these challenging times with all the division and turmoil in politics, racial injustice, economic inequality, and more, what should preachers be doing in their pulpits in this sort of environment? How can preaching help us get through this?
You know, there are two psalms. One that says, set me on a rock that is higher than I. Mm. And another that says, I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills. Mm. From whence cometh my help? My help cometh from the Lord. Preachers, preaching, must set us on a rock that is higher than our lower selves. Mm. It must point to the hills from whence cometh our help. In other words, we must, in preaching, invite, summon, call, challenge, cajole, nurture, whatever the right language is, all of us to go higher. To claim higher ground, to not settle for the low ground, to claim the higher self, to as St. Paul says in Philippians, to press on to the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. That is the task of preaching. And preaching that does that will not be just airy-fairy. Mm. Preaching that does that will claim the high values and the nobility of the gospel and the nobility of what Jesus teaches us and then invite us to dare to live that in our lives. Mm. Preaching that does that will take us to the Mount of the Transfiguration where Jesus appeared and some of his disciples, Peter, Andrew, and John, Peter, James, and John, saw him and saw Jesus for who he is in all his glory, but they had to come back down from the mountain. Preaching will take us up to the mountaintop and show us the vision of God's glory and then show us how to live that vision in a world that can't see it. Mm. That's what preaching must do. And so I think that kind of preaching, if you will, has the capacity to point us in the way, in the direction of a way of life that does not settle for the division, that does not settle for the lowest common denominator, but that actually lifts up our eyes to the hills from whence cometh our help.
Well, Bishop Michael, your sermon today focuses on a powerful text from the Gospel of John, chapter 13. Would you read it for us?
From John chapter 13, after Jesus had washed his disciples' feet, he put on a robe and had returned to the table. He then said to them, Do you know what I have done to you? You call me Lord and teacher, and you are right, for that is what I am. So if I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have set you an example, that you should also do as I have done to you. I give you a new commandment, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, so you should love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, that you have love for one another.
We look forward to hearing your sermon. It's called Not Just Me, But We. Bishop Curry, thank you for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you. It's been a privilege. A few years ago, Professor Charles Marsh of the University of Virginia wrote a book on spirituality and the civil rights movement and said, Jesus had founded the most revolutionary movement in human history, a movement built on the unconditional love of God for the world and the mandate to live that love. It's true. Jesus of Nazareth began the most profoundly revolutionary movement in history. It was a movement of people for whom this Jesus, his teaching, his example, his risen life, became the epicenter of their lives, and whose way of love became their way of life. As a result, their lives were changed, and they, in turn, changed the world around them. It's not just about me. It's about we. I give you a new commandment, that you love one another just as I have loved you. At the Last Supper, just hours before Jesus would be pulled from his knees in prayer and arrested, then tried and tortured, and eventually executed by the Empire of Rome, Jesus said this, I give you a new commandment, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, so you should love one another. The command wasn't new. New Testament professor Amy Jill Levine of Vanderbilt Seminary in Nashville, commenting on our text, stops in place and asks, so what's new? Jesus' teaching on love, which is the center of his message, is built on the teaching of Moses. In Matthew's gospel, Jesus told a lawyer that the greatest law is to love God, to love your neighbor as yourself. He was quoting and referring to Deuteronomy chapter 6 and Leviticus chapter 19. The command to love God, neighbor, and self is not new. It wasn't new then or now. Jesus made it the centerpiece of his message. But it wasn't new. So what's new, Professor Levine says? Here's what's new. The words, just as I have loved you. I give you a new commandment that you love one another. That part's not new. Then he says, just as I have loved you, so you should love one another. You are to love as you have been loved by me, loved by God. You are to love and be loved, to give and receive, to do justice and to be treated with justice, to show mercy and to receive mercy. In other words, love is not just about you. It's about us. It's not just about me. It's about we. And that makes all the difference in the world. And that way of love is potentially the most revolutionary movement in all of human reality. I never saw it this way before, but it's all over the teachings of Jesus. Just take a look at the beginning of John chapter 13, where our text comes from. Jesus washes the feet of his disciples. That was never done. The teacher doesn't wash the feet of his students. The master doesn't wash the feet of the slave. The wealthy don't wash the feet of the poor, and on and on and on. But Jesus washes his disciples' feet. He turns the existing world order not only upside down, but right side up. And Peter, if you read the text carefully, is the one who resists and says, no, I should wash your feet. Not the other way around. But Jesus says, no, if you don't do it, if you don't let me do it, you are not part of me. You have no share in me. Then Jesus says, I have given you an example. Wash each other's feet. Live in equality, mutuality, and the reciprocity of God's beloved community. And it's soon after that Jesus says, a new commandment I give you, that you love one another as I have loved you. This is the way of love. You are to love and be loved, to give and to receive, to do justice and to be justly done unto. It's not just about me. It's about we. God made us to give and receive, to bless and be blessed, to love and to be loved, to do justice, love mercy, walk humbly with God. It's not just about me, but we. And brothers, sisters, siblings, that is a revolution. I was about 12 or 13 when I had a conversation with my father that I still remember. I don't know what the subject matter was, but whatever I said, my father blurted out, "You know, the Lord didn't put you here just to consume the oxygen." I don't think that was a considered, reasoned, philosophical, or theological statement. It was more likely a classic parental response to 13-year-old hormones expressing themselves. But whatever the case, he really said something important. The Lord didn't put me here. He didn't put you here. He didn't put us here just to consume oxygen. We're not just here for mere biological purposes. The key word in the sentence is just. We are not here just to consume the oxygen, but we are here in part to consume oxygen. Think about it for a moment. The world of living things is so constructed that there is an intimate, interconnected, symbiotic, biological, ecological relationship between various forms of life, between all humans, between human beings and other forms of life and existence. In his letter from a Birmingham jail, Dr. King put it this way: "We are bound together in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. We are here in part to consume the oxygen, but not just to consume." Think about it. I've been out of school a long time, but if I remember correctly, the biological process of photosynthesis may be a parable of this principle. We and all animals inhale oxygen, and we exhale carbon dioxide. All forms of plant life, in turn, inhale or take in the carbon dioxide, and they release or exhale the oxygen. In other words, they give us what we need, and we give them what they need. Now, does anybody really think that that's just an accident or coincidence? The poet was right. The hand that made us is divine. That's not an accident. That's a parable. We are here to inhale and to exhale. We are here to receive and to give, to be loved and to love, to be cared for and to care, to be justly treated and to treat others justly, to have food, clothing, and shelter, and to labor for a world where every man, woman, and child has adequate food, adequate clothing, adequate shelter, to be treated equally with the human rights intended by God for all, and to labor so that all are equal in our society and global communities. No, the Lord didn't put us here just to consume. The Lord also put us here to give, to serve, to love. The old Hebrew prophet Micah said it best. You have heard what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? But to do justice, to love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. No, my brothers, my sisters, my siblings, Jesus started a movement, the most revolutionary movement in history, a movement built on the way of love that teaches us how to live, not just for me, but for we. And that is a revolution. Now, I know somebody's thinking, this is fine, preacher. It's fine for church and good to talk about this kind of love, not just for me, but for we. But it's a cold and cruel, tough world out there. I may be revealing too much about myself, but I'm a big fan of Clint Eastwood. Like many of you, I grew up on Clint Eastwood films. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Hang 'em High. There probably is no greater sentence in the English language than, go ahead, make my day. My wife knew that and exploited it once. She wanted to see Bridges Over Madison County. She talked me into going by telling me that Clint Eastwood was in it. I thought it was a war movie. It was a love story with Meryl Streep. I have never forgiven her for that. But beyond the shoot 'em ups, Clint Eastwood has actually made some significant and socially important films. Over the years, he's actually made some incredible films. In the film Bird, he told the story of the jazz great Charlie Blackbird Parker. In the film Unforgiven, he taught us about forgiveness, maybe one of the most profound films on what it means to be forgiven. In Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima, he looked at the Second World War in the Pacific from the perspective of Americans and the perspective of Japanese. In Mystic River, he dealt with the pain of child abuse. In Million Dollar Baby, he dealt with deep relationships between human beings coming from different worlds. In the film The Mule, he dealt with hard decisions, drug dealing, the complexity of life's decisions. In Gran Torino, he dealt with racism and the possibility of redemption and even reconciliation. But maybe his greatest achievement, or at least my favorite, was the film Invictus, the story of Nelson Mandela and the people of South Africa, the story of how a nation divided by race, class, color, avoided a racial civil war between black, white, colored, a war that would have rendered the streets of Johannesburg and Cape Town, Soweto, red with the flow of human blood, Invictus. Early in the film, after Mandela had been released from prison, after a new democracy was being established and elections held, and he was elected president, Mandela assumed office. He walked into the government complex, the equivalent of the White House. As he entered on this first day, you could see most of the white government employees emptying their drawers, packing their things, getting ready to leave. They assumed they knew what was coming. He ordered all the government workers to meet him in a large auditorium. All the previous staff were white. All the staff of the African National Congress were black or colored. The same was true of the security details, and all were present and armed. He spoke to the two security details and said they must find ways to become one security detail. Needless to say, neither group was thrilled. And then he turned and addressed everyone in the room. Black, colored, and white alike. And he said something like this: the Rainbow Nation begins here. Reconciliation begins here. Forgiveness begins here. And forgiveness is the power that liberates the soul. Love begins today. And today, the new South Africa begins. When I heard that, something inside of me said, that's not the language of power politics. I took political philosophy in college. I read Plato about the philosopher king. I read Machiavelli's The Prince. I read Locke and Hobbes and Marx and Engels. I read Kwame Nkrumah's Africa Must Unite. I've read about politics. I've been around politicians my whole life. But I've not once heard one talk about reconciliation, forgiveness, justice, and love. That's not the typical language of power politics. That's the language of Jesus. That's what the Master taught us. Love. Forgiveness. Reconciliation. What does the Lord require of you? But to do justice, to love mercy, to walk humbly with your God. What does Jesus say? Love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. A new commandment I give you, that you love one another. A friend of mine, the Anglican Archbishop of Southern Africa, Archbishop Thabo, spent the last year and a half, praying with Nelson Mandela as Mandela faced his own death. At the request of the family, and with their permission, he published a book on that last year and a half, and he titled it Faith and Courage, Praying with Mandela. In the last few years of Mandela's life, the Archbishop came to know that this was a man of profound and real faith who actually tried to follow in the footsteps and in the way of Jesus of Nazareth and his love. And when the record is written, it will show that Nelson Mandela and others like him led a revolution in South Africa, a revolution that did not degenerate into hatred and violence and bloodshed. It did not degenerate into a racial civil war. They led a revolution based on love and justice and truth and reconciliation that created a multiracial society. Do not be deceived. Love is the most potent reality in all of the universe. A new commandment I give you. Love one another as I have loved you, and you will discover that love is the greatest revolution possible. God love you. God bless you. And may God hold us all in those almighty hands of love.
Our preacher today was the Most Reverend Michael Curry, the presiding bishop and primate of the Episcopal Church, headquartered in New York City. For a free transcript of his sermon for the 15th Sunday after Pentecost, call us at 404-815-9110. That's 404-815-9110. Or write to us at Day One, 2715 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia, 30305. And please keep in mind that Day One depends on the financial contributions of our faithful listeners. We're grateful for your support. This is Peter Wallace. Next week, as we conclude our special 75th anniversary series of programs, we're delighted to have with us the Reverend Dr. Greg Deloach, Interim Dean of Mercer University McAfee School of Theology in Atlanta, Georgia. Be sure to listen for his inspiring message. That's next time on Day One. Now, Bishop Michael Curry shares some final reflections on today's message. Michael, Jesus of Nazareth began the most profoundly revolutionary movement in history, a movement of love, you told us. It's a movement that says it's not about just me, it's about we. Feels like we've moved far away from this movement of love, especially in this time of fighting over wearing masks to protect others. How do you suggest we be more intentional about keeping the big picture of this movement of love in our hearts and minds as we live our lives amid the myriad of fears and pains and threats each day brings?
Well, I can tell you that the this sermon came in part from an interview that I did maybe about a year ago. And actually, it was in the Harvard Business Review. And the interview was about love. And the interviewer said, you know, how does this apply to a corporate CEO? I mean, it makes sense in terms of our interpersonal relationships, but how can this apply, this principle of love, be applied for a CEO?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, let me give you some language that's not particularly religious, but that's getting at what I'm talking about. And that's where I said, if you live by it's all about me, or even primarily about me, if I'm the center of the universe, then there's not that much room for you. But if you live by the principle of we, then there's, as the slaves used to say, plenty good room for all God's children. And I was, you know, addressing corporate CEOs, but this would apply to anybody. Just ask yourself the practical question, is this decision that I must make, is this action that I must take, is it motivated primarily about me? Is it basically based on some kind of selfish intention, or is it about we? And just always ask yourself the me or we question before any decision as actions are taken. And that can apply to everybody. That's the love question. Is it just about me or is it about we? And that gets at what I think is the root issue in love, that love is the antidote, the cure for what John Stuart Mill called unenlightened self-interest. Unbridled selfishness, or Reinhold Niebuhr called it inordinate self-will, which is what the Bible means by sin. Love, which is unselfish and even sacrificial, that looks for the good and the welfare and the well-being of others as well as yourself, that kind of love is liberating and life-giving for everybody. And so the me and we question, is this just about me? Is this just serving me or my family or my party or my religion or my ethnic group or my national group or my nation group? Or is it serving we? That is the defining question for love.
This command to love wasn't new to Jesus's listeners. It goes back to the Old Testament, you said. But as Amy Jill Levine points out, what's new here is that we are to love as we have been loved by Jesus, loved by God.
Exactly.
To love and be loved, yeah. To give and receive, to do justice and to be treated with justice, to show mercy and to receive mercy. This is why God made us, you said, not just to consume oxygen, but to share carbon dioxide. How can this realization spur us on as we live this way of love?
Well, you know, I mean, I have an image in my head. You remember when Billy Graham used to have his crusades? And at the end of the crusade, you know, the choir would start singing Just As I Am without one plea. And then Billy would have the altar call and he would invite folk to come, you know, come on down. And I had this image. My grandmother used to love to watch Billy Graham. And I had this image of a daily altar call that every morning when you get up. Just imagine that maybe God is saying to you, are you ready to live this day not just for me, but for we? And that we includes everybody else, and it includes God. You ready to live your day that way? That's an altar call for daily living. And I want to suggest that Just that little spiritual practice, just something like that has the potential to be, what would you call, a constant reminder that might be able to help to guide us and to spur us on. There's something else. On some level, and I think this is true for religious folk, but on some level, I really do think most of us really want to live lives that actually matter. The old black preachers used to have a funeral sermon, which got preached at a lot of funerals, and they basically would ask, what did you do with your dash? And they would go on to say, you know, when you go to the cemetery and you see headstones and, you know, it says Michael Currier or, you know, Peter Wallace or whoever, and then you'll see the date of birth and the date of death, and between the two was a little dash. And the old preacher would say, you know, it really doesn't matter that much what the date of your birth is because you didn't have anything to do with that. And it really doesn't matter that much what the date of your death is because you probably didn't have that much to do with that either. But what you did have control over was what you did with the dash in between. Most of us want to live lives. They don't have to be great and famous. They don't have to be lives of wealth and fortune. But most of us want to live a life where the dash makes a difference. And I think that is potential inspiration for every one of us.
Bishop Michael Currie, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, and happy 75th anniversary. You don't look a day over 20.
Celebrating 75 years of ministry, Day One is the voice of America's historic Protestant churches. Visit us online at dayone.org. Our program is recorded and edited by Donald Jones and produced by Peter Wallace. Thank you for listening. I'm Sherry Miller wishing you all God's blessings on Day One and forever.